Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast features the 7th of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George P. Shultz. Originally recorded in 2006, Shultz speaks with former National Security Council member and colleague in the Reagan administration, Richard Pipes. During this conversation, the two discuss their time in the administration and specifically discuss how they feel their time impacted world history. We hope you enjoy this week's episode and be sure to stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Nice to be here and to see you, Mr. Secretary. We were in Washington at the same time. You were Secretary of State. I was member of the National Security Council. And I remember these days very fondly because I think we made a difference in world history.
Well, we had a little assistance from a man named Ronald Reagan.
We sure did. Yeah, but we gave him advice and he was remarkable. We were just discussing before the cameras went on these four volumes of his radio remarks, how remarkable they are. I have not seen them, but I've read reviews and people say they're an eye-opener. That he's how
well, you know what he did between when he was governor and when he was president. He made his living in part by these short radio addresses, mm-hmm. 5 minutes. And he wrote out what he was going to say in longhand. And we discovered these essays.
Oh.
And they were published in their four books. Two of them are the essays, and one is stories that he wrote out, yeah. And the fourth one is letters. He wrote huge volumes of letters.
He liked to write letters.
And he had, when he became president, he liked to answer any letter that anybody wrote him. And they said to him, well, you can't answer all these letters. So he said, all right, take at random 10 letters. Oh. And when I got to Camp David, I'll answer them. So he'd take his letters and he'd write out his answers, stick them in an envelope, seal the envelope, and then take it back to be mailed. So it drove the staff crazy. They didn't know what he said in the letters. And so all they knew was who it went to.
I see.
And we had those records so you could write to people.
So
they wouldn't give you the letter, but they would give you
copy. I see, they sent you a copy.
There were a lot of letters in the archives.
I know it's an eye-opener. A lot of people said that it's remarkable. They didn't realize he could think this way.
You know, an act of writing, you've written a lot.
Okay.
When you write, I have this experience. It's a learning experience. When you're trying to express yourself clearly, you're making yourself think.
That's right.
Clearly. And a person who writes is a person who just must think. And that's what Ronald Reagan was doing. He thinks his way through things by writing.
Yes, he was a remarkable man. I mean, I was the only Harvard professor who went to work for him. And a lot of people thought that it was a terrible mistake that I did that. Now, there was one more man who was, I think, a professor of economics, was in the Council of Economic Advisors. But I was the only sort of on the political side. People ask me, is he intelligent? Does he know what he's talking about? I would always say the same thing. I mean, if he has very profound judgment. He's not a very learned man. He didn't read very much. But he had the most important quality, which is judgment. And he understood things extremely well. And I think that's appreciated today.
Yes, it is.
It wasn't then.
Well, there was an outpouring when he died.
Yes, amazing.
Sympathy and respect and affection for him.
That tremendous.
The country just erupted.
Yeah. Well, he was a terribly kind man. My only disagreement with him was on Russia, that he thought that the Soviet leaders, like leaders anywhere, want their people to be prosperous and happy and free. And I said, no, Mr. President, that's not so. They don't want that because their power depends on them being suppressed and being frightened by allegedly American designs on the Soviet Union. He couldn't understand it because he was basically so kind. Eventually, I think he did understand at the very end. When I left in December 82. I remember at some meeting, he said, I now know they don't want the happiness and the prosperity of their people. But it took a long time to come into it.
Well, he didn't have any direct personal contact.
No, not until Gorbachev.
Soviet leaders. And as he said, when he was asked once why he didn't have meetings with them, he said, they keep dying on me. And there was a succession of quite old, in those terms, people that weren't there very long. And
no, that's right.
Died.
There was Andropov, who was very ill with some kind of kidney disease, I think, and he died within a year. And then
Chernenko.
Chernenko also died within the year. But
in Gorbachev, he found a person to whom he could talk. Gorbachev was a man who liked ideas, yeah, and who you could have an exchange with.
You could. But the first meeting was not so warm.
Oh, no. It was very good.
That was good. But I've read what Gorbachev told his Politburo when he came back. And he said he's a troglodyte, meaning a very, very primitive man. But then they clicked after that. And,
they clicked in Geneva.
Very well.
Whatever Gorbachev may have said.
No, because Reagan was looking for some kind of action from the Soviet side, and he got it from Gorbachev. And Gorbachev now, he just celebrated the 20th anniversary of coming to power, and they attended a conference of his in Turin, where he has an institute. And he called it 20 years that changed the world. And he thinks that perestroika lies in the future, not only for Russia, but for the whole world. So he's very confident of himself.
And the last visit I had with Deng Xiaoping,
yes,
was in July 1988. And Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika were still riding reasonably high at that point.
Yes.
So I asked Deng Xiaoping what he thought of Gorbachev's reforms. And he said, he's got it all backwards. He's loosened up the political system. He doesn't have a clue on what to do with the economy. It's going to blow up in his face.
Well, but just in a way, right.
So then I said, well, what about you in China? And he said, well, I'm doing it right. I'm opening up the economy, starting in the small businesses and farms. And it's growing, and it works. So people want more of what works. I'm giving them what they want, and it's spreading. And I said, what about the political system? He said, well, it will become more often, but it will be the same way. It'll start at the bottom and work itself up.
Well, that's right, because I mean, you cannot have a totalitarian system with a free economy. As people get rich, they want a voice in politics. And it's already happening in China now. The political system is sort of slowly melting, I think. But Gorbachev didn't. He strange man. But Reagan felt very quickly that he's a man he can do business with. Mrs. Thatcher told him that, and things went okay. But now he's given a lot of credit in Russia for having destroyed the system. More credit in Russia than here. I mean, George Kennan, a few years before he died, when people were congratulating Reagan on having brought down this communist regime, wrote, I was amazed by that, that on the contrary, Reagan's policy prolonged the existence of the Soviet system. I think very perverse.
Yeah, and wrong.
Yeah. Well, what do you do these days?
Well, I hang around Hoover and
you do
things here, and I
yeah,
active on the campus. I give talks, I write books.
I see.
And I have a little politics. I don't see much of Washington, but I'm the chairman of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Council of Economic Advisors. So I go up to Sacramento.
I see.
And I do a little business. So I a nice life of combining these things.
Yes, well, I'm retired too. I enjoy it thoroughly.
I'm not retired.
You're not retired.
I'm doing things.
Well, of course, but you didn't have a professorship when you came back, did you?
Yes, I was a professor. Now I'm an emeritus professor.
So am I.
They offered me a chair, and I said, I don't want a chair, I want a couch.
Well, I'm also an emeritus, but it's a nice life.
Yes, yeah, very nice.
And what do you think of the present administration? What is your attitude?
They're doing mostly all the right things.
I think so.
And they're having it, but implementation is tough. And the atmosphere in Washington, when I occasionally go dip into it, is not like anything I experienced either in the Nixon or the Reagan administration.
It's poisonous. It's terribly poisonous. Vicious.
I mean, for example, the Social Security system, everybody knows, needs reform.
Reform, yeah.
It's not a controversial thing to say that. So President Bush tried to open the subject up, which is courageous to bring it up. And he didn't. He got a lot of opposition. He didn't get anywhere. So he said how frustrated he was in his State of the Union message, and the Democrats all clapped. So where is the willingness to take on a difficult problem?
I'm an immigrant. I wasn't born here, but I came to this country when I was 17 years old. And I've never seen, and I voted for the first time for President Roosevelt in 1944 when I was in the armed forces. I've never seen this kind of partisanship, this kind of viciousness, which there are people here who really almost hope that we fail on everything we do. I don't understand it. It's very troublesome. The country is very divided down the middle.
I'm not so sure that's true.
No, you don't think it's right?
I have a colleague here at Hoover Institution who's written an interesting book. It's entitled Culture Wars? The Myth of a Divided
America. What's his name?
Mo Fiorina is his name. He's a political scientist. And what he has done is interview a lot of people who are Republicans, declare themselves to be Republicans and declare themselves to be Democrats. And he asked them the same questions about all sorts of sensitive issues, like abortion and gun control and gays and so on. And the result is there's not much difference of opinion.
Really?
The same sort of variations in opinion.
In both parties?
In both parties. So what he is getting at is the politicians are out here and they're attacking each other. Most of the American people are still
in the middle.
Somewhere in the center, and they're not so divided. So you're waiting for a politician to come along who can somehow tap into the center and at the same time keep the extreme in his party on his side.
At the universities, I'm afraid it's not so. The universities are very much controlled by people of the left.
The universities aren't divided.
No, they are united on the wrong side. But you know, at the average university, major university, the proportion of Republicans to Democrats is 1 to 10. And a place like Brown, 1 to 30. So they completely dominate. The students are different. The students are much more divided and not so opinionated, but the faculty is very one-sided. It's troublesome. I'm sure they're educating.
Well, let's go back to the Reagan era and the flow of his relationships with the Soviet Union. It always seemed to me, in getting to know Ronald Reagan, even going back to the early primaries where I worked for him and then all through there, that he loved bargaining. And he often talked, we talked about labor relations days and his time as head of the Screen Actors Guild, where he bargained. And he was very aware that if you were going to be successful in bargaining, you had to bring some strength to the table. And then you had a basis for
which is what he did with the Russians.
So broadly speaking, he said, we need to get ourselves up in our military capability, in our economy, in our self-confidence. And when we do those things, we will be dealing from strength.
That's right.
And once we get into that position, then it's important to be ready to deal and to work. And I think there were a lot of people who felt it's good to be strong, but let's not bother dealing with the Russians, we'll just be strong.
No, but there were also people on the other side who said, if you build up your strength too much, you're going to get another Stalin on the Soviet side, because they will respond to your toughness with similar toughness. But it was all wrong, because instead we got Gorbachev, who was willing to negotiate.
He was, but also I think it became apparent to Gorbachev that he had a hard time to keep up in any major arms race with the United States, because we're such a big, powerful economy.
They could not keep up.
And then came the Strategic Defense Initiative. And it turned out to be a wonderful bargaining chip, even though that chip was never put on the table in terms of the basic program.
Yeah.
But I remember we had a proposal to agree not to deploy anything for 7 years.
I mean the defenses, ballistic defenses,
And I remember saying to the president, you know, if you can get something for that, it'll be terrific, because we don't have anything to deploy. It's like giving them the sleeves to your vest. Right. He loved that idea. I'm going to give them the sleeves to my vest, and I'm going to get something for it. But at any rate, there was a extraordinary interchange between Reagan and Gorbachev.
Is that Reykjavik or before Reykjavik?
Reykjavik was where this came to its head, but the proposal had gone out formally before that. So at any rate, Reykjavik, in retrospect, was a gigantic conference, and what we saw was the Soviet bottom line, and all of that, those concessions that they put out in Reykjavik gradually came true.
Yeah.
And things that President Reagan had proposed early on, like the elimination of intermediate range nuclear forces and cutting strategic arms in half. And I remember when he put those proposals forward, people said they're ridiculous. It shows that he's not even serious about bargaining. And then by Reykjavik, he had them. Basically, they weren't agreed to, but basically.
No, they were frightened of these defenses. I talked to some Russians, lower level Russians, but also to some Europeans from smaller countries, to whom they talked more readily than they did to us. And they told them that if the Americans make up their mind to do something in the field of technology, they will do it. So they didn't share the doubts of the American scientific community that this is not possible or feasible. They believe it's feasible.
Well, also that you get the American scientific establishment working on something, and beyond whatever might be achieved in strategic defense, all kinds of other things are likely to be thought
right.
of, and
yeah.
it'll be a problem.
Yeah.
So anyway, it turned out very well.
Turned out very well. And Reagan gets a lot of credit in the Soviet Union. I mean, not everybody there is happy that the Soviet Union collapsed. A lot of people have nostalgia, particularly the older generation. But, there's no way of going back to it. We see now a survival of the Soviet system in Belorussia, where you have an incipient Stalin in power, and where people have nothing to say. Elections are rigged, and police beats up protesters. Media are all in the hands of the government. The Russians don't want that. The president of Belorussia, or Belarusia as it's now known, wants a union with Russia, but they don't want it. Because they're afraid that he will try to take over and impose the same system on them.
Well, but that's no bargain to have Belarus who wants it.
No. Well, it's the only one, maybe now we're not, the Ukraine may be drifting the same way because the election's coming up and apparently the outcome is not certain. But Ukraine is an important country, but Belarus is not. It's a very poor country. It survives only because they're getting very cheap energy from the Russians.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen my memoirs called Vixie. Have you had a chance to look at those?
No, I haven't seen them.
Yeah, they came out about 3 years ago. And I speak very enthusiastically about my days in Washington. They were very exhilarating because I really felt I was contributing in some way to something that's very desirable, which is the end of the Soviet Union. I never had any illusions about that system. But unfortunately, for many reasons, Russians are not accustomed to freedom or democracy. They identify, that's very troublesome, they identify freedom and democracy of chaos and anarchy and crime. So they want a very strong ruler. No matter how he's elected and whether he obeys the law or does not, but he maintains order. When they're asked in polls, I did a study of public
opinion. Have you been to Moscow lately?
Yes, I go there almost. I go there every year.
The traffic.
Oh, the traffic.
They could use somebody who will take charge of the traffic patterns. We know how to do that a lot better.
Yeah. And the constant accidents. They have constant accidents. They bump into each other, stop the traffic, they get out of the car, take the pens, write down the number and so on. The traffic is terrible. There was a story about, they have a circular road around Moscow. There's one man got on it and he was lost for 2 weeks because he couldn't find his way out of it. But they did a poll, a public opinion poll in one of the provinces in central Russia. It's called Voronezh. And they asked people, what is more important to you personally, freedom or order? And 85% said order and only 15% said freedom. Because, as I say, freedom to them is chaos.
Well, but somebody should say, suppose you can have freedom and order.
Of course, they're not incompatible at all. But their experience hasn't been like that. you must have seen how the Council on Foreign Relations just published a book on that, and that we should be much rougher on the Russians than we are, and criticize them more for the suppression of freedoms and so on. But I think President Bush believes that Putin is a partner in the fight against terror, which I don't believe he is. I mean, he has a special problem in Chechnya, but that problem could be very easily solved if you give him independence. Our problem with the Muslims, I mean, the West Europe and America, is much profounder, because they really want to subvert our civilization, whereas it's not the case in Russia. So I don't think that Putin really is a partner in this, but that's the belief in Washington. So we are very, very generous to him, and we don't criticize him.
Well, he gets plenty of criticism, I think.
Well, now it's coming out, yes, but for a long time, no.
But we should be dealing with him just as it was important to deal with the Soviet Union.
Yes.
In part because they have a huge trove of nuclear, biological, and chemical materials. And you've got to keep your eye on that.
They can't make up their mind whether they want to work with us or against us. They are very confused where they are, where they belong, because they are a world unto itself. That goes back to the Middle Ages in Russia. Orthodoxy, after the fall of Constantinople in the 15th century, Russia was the only Orthodox country left in the world. And they didn't belong to the West, because the West was Catholic, and they became Catholic and Protestant. And of course, they're not to Islam in the South or to Buddhism in the East. And they have this problem where they belong. And the other problem they have is that they want to be a great power, and they feel they are not treated as a great power. So that upsets them very much.
But they have something else.
Which is?
That's got to trouble them. And it shows, I think, a sick society. Their birth rate is very low.
Oh, it's falling, yeah. Well,
and they are the only country of any consequence where the age of death is declining.
Declining, yeah.
So the population is
shrinking, yeah.
And it's extraordinary, and without any parallel anywhere else.
Because, you know, until the Soviet period, they had the highest rate of population growth in Europe. If you consider Russia a European country, they had the highest rate. And then with Stalin, collectivization and so on, and population growth began to drop, and keeps on declining. And I've seen predictions what will be happen in a year 2050. Will look very bad for them.
If trends continue, you've got to believe that the age of death will start to rise.
Yeah.
And they get more in line with what's true in most other reasonably developed countries.
Well, the alcoholism is very high. A lot of people die from drinking.
Women live something like 12 years on the average longer than men.
Yeah.
And the men are killing themselves by alcohol.
By drinking.
I remember a little incident I had with Gromyko once. You remember that Gorbachev, when he took over, started a campaign against vodka and made it very hard to get vodka. And we had this long meeting in Vienna, and then we sat next to each other at dinner, and of course Gromyko spoke English so we could talk. And he was bragging to me about Gorbachev's effort to curtail drinking of alcohol. And I said, well, you have to watch out for that. We tried it in the United States once, and it didn't work out too well. And I said, also, you have to worry about jokes in the street. When you start being the butt of jokes, look out, in the politics, that's the worst thing that can happen to you. And I said, for instance, there's a story going around. These two guys are standing in line at the vodka store.
In Moscow.
In Moscow. And they're standing in line for an hour and a half. They're gradually moving up in the line. And finally, one of them says, I'm sick of this. I'm going over to the Kremlin to shoot Gorbachev. So he leaves. But a half an hour later, he comes back, and his buddy has moved up in the line a little bit. And the buddy looks at him and says, well, did you shoot him? He says, hell no, the line up there is a lot longer than this one.
Well, you know that attempt to stop Russians from drinking vodka was back to the 17th century. They had a patriarch called Nikon, and he tried to do it, and it didn't work.
Yeah, it's impossible.
It goes back to the Russian Primary Chronicle, which is a medieval document. It tells how the Russian state was founded. And they describe how the prince who was going to convert the pagan Russians called in a rabbi, called in a Muslim, and called in a Christian from Byzantium. And he asked the Jewish rabbi, well, what is your religion? What is your home? He said, well, we don't have a home. We were dispersed by God for our sins. Well, we don't want that religion. And then he asked the Muslim, says, what is your religion? Well, we have such and such rules, but one of them is you cannot drink. And in the primary chronicle, it says, no, that's not for us, because for us Russians, it is more gay to drink. And that is... But of course, they only discovered alcohol late in the 16th century, I think, from the Muslims, who use it for medical purposes.
Alcohol allegedly.
Alcohol is an Arabic word, I think. But from then on, you just couldn't stop it. But they not only drink vodka, they drink all kinds of cooling elements and hair lotions and so anything with alcohol in it. And they poison themselves. I saw a statistic that said, that was about 10 years ago, something like 40,000 Russians died annually from alcohol poisoning. Not from overdose of alcohol, or pseudo-sulivir, just from poisoning. And Russian women have endless abortions. I don't know. 6, 8, 10 abortions per woman. Well, you can bring up a child. You have to have a lot of money to bring up a child in Russia. And they just don't have it.
And yet, they're a big problem.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming all the way.
It was a pleasure.
Have a little talk here.
I haven't seen you in about 25 years, I think.
A long time.
Yes.
But
good. All the best.
The world is different.
Very good.
Thank you.